This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And I believe that's me, the ever-famous, ever-infamous, always important, but never seen, Rick Moore. Thank you for joining us here on Sunday, the Sunday before Thanksgiving. That's right. Be thankful that we're here again this Sunday. Be thankful that Rusty is here this Sunday and next Sunday. Rusty performs double duty next Sunday as he does bluegrass and then is the guest on the wake-up call for our annual version of WNRN's Car Talk. But this week in the studio, as I get my important information from Sean McCord, I know that we have David C. Smith in the studio, but I didn't have all the important titles that go along with it. David C. Smith, associate professor from the McIntyre School here at UVA, but also director of the McIntyre Center for Financial Innovation. David, what's the last part? I mean, I'm familiar, and I would assume that many of our listeners, associate professor in the McIntyre School of Commerce, the undergraduate school of business at the University of Virginia, director of the McIntyre Center for Financial Innovation. a little explanation, please.
That sounds fancy. It is a center, essentially a pool of money that's been provided by our generous McIntyre donors, mostly alumni, that's there for us to, the faculty at the McIntyre School of Commerce, to use to further the field of finance, to understand better the workings of financial markets, financial institutions, and how we can make them better. And I'm the director, so I help figure out things to do to make the center more public, give it a public presence, provide some value to the public, some value to the students, and to provide resources to our faculty as they conduct research in the area of financial economics and finance.
All right, so that's our guest today, David C. Smith from the McIntyre School of Commerce and the director of the McIntyre Center for Financial Innovation. I think we're going to have a really great hour lined up. Write down the numbers today. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Stretch those muscles. Nobody should pull a finger muscle just before they're going to use it to eat all week. Let me take a moment and thank some of our underwriters today, the Blue Ridge Graphics. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and online, brgtshirts.com. All right, if you hadn't figured out or heard the promos all week, we are going to be speaking with Professor David C. Smith. Don't be confused, because there's a Professor David G. Smith at the McIntyre School as well.
Yeah.
Apparently a nice guy.
Much better respected guy than me.
Much better respected guy. And that's why he insists you use the C there so there's no confusion. So David C. Smith, we're going to talk about the economy. We're going to spend a lot of the hour talking about the automakers, their request for loans from the federal government. Because your specialty is bankruptcy, is one of your specialties, correct?
That's right, corporate bankruptcies.
And so you've been very busy. But, in the calendar year.
It's after a few years of not much going on, it looks to be starting up in a way that's going to make learning about bankruptcies and following what's going on a much busier time. That's right.
All right. Well, let's jump right into things because it was at the end of this past week that, and I really don't like the name, but I'm going to use it through the hour, the big three, Ford, Motor Company, General Motors, and Chrysler all approached the federal government to ask for what did they call them? Bridge loans?
Bridge loans. You know, you'll hear the term bailout, federal assistance, direct financial assistance from the taxpayers to these automakers, yes.
And explain that a little bit, because I understand that a bridge loan, what they've asked for is a lot of money to carry them through a time period where they won't have enough cash on hand to run their corporations, to buy their parts, to pay their people, et cetera, correct?
That's correct. All these three companies are burning cash faster than they can make it. Certainly it has a lot to do with the slowdown in the economy. It has something to do with the fact that it's very much harder to raise new liquid short-term financing through markets currently. It also has a lot to do with the fact that they just aren't earning enough money to generate cash. So they've come to the federal government. GM, I think, believes that there's a good chance they will run out of cash. That means they will not be able to meet their suppliers, their creditors, the payment obligations that they have by sometime in December if they don't get some sort of assistance or do something else besides what's currently being done at these companies.
And how does that make them special and different from these what must be hundreds of other large businesses having these same problems, who are burning cash faster than they can raise it, who are having trouble or will soon have trouble to pay their creditors and all the other issues that you just mentioned?
Well, that's a great question, Rick. I'm not sure if I have the right answer. I'd say the answer is more political than anything else. There's a belief that's, I think, promoted by the auto manufacturers that they're the sort of base, the backbone of the U.S. manufacturing sector. And therefore, if they're struggling, if they're having troubles, then and there's any danger that they could cease to exist, that the consequences would be so horrible that the nation as a whole, the government, the taxpayers should want to help them out. And I think that's the pitch they're making. But I would tend to second the point you're already making, that there are literally tens of thousands of companies that file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, file for bankruptcy in the U.S. bankruptcy courts. Thousands go out of business. Others go into bankruptcy, come out better companies. This includes large companies, entire sectors. Probably most in the audience have at least heard that many of our airline companies have had to file for bankruptcy. Many of the largest energy companies have had to file for bankruptcy in the past few years. So it certainly isn't unusual to a U.S. company, even to a U.S. manufacturer, for something like this to happen.
Yet, you mentioned it's more political. Explain that to me, please.
Well, I only say it's political in the sense that if we set aside the financial sector and just look, say, at the manufacturing sector, the service sector, those folks who work in regular companies out there that make things and provide services to us, waves and waves of companies will run into cash troubles at different times, maybe specific to an industry, specific to a company. But you don't often have the CEOs coming up before Congress, making it the top news item on the weekly news shows. That they're going out of business and they're having trouble. Everybody else seems to go out of business, have struggle with their troubles, and get through their problems without so much fanfare. So my argument that this is political is that the automakers tend to have it differently. It looks that way.
Well, in some sense, aren't they correct that, and I think the phrase that I used was affected arteries, if they were to go bankrupt, so many businesses would be affected by their loss, correct?
Well, that's where I guess, and one of the reasons I enjoy studying bankruptcy, actually it's not quite correct because the typical thought is even the word bankruptcy sort of conjures up this idea that the company is going out of business, it's being liquidated, putting to rest, so it just becomes a memory.
That's
and nothing else.
Circuit City. We have one up 29
well, in Circuit,
North, right?
In Circuit City, it may, and actually Circuit City may go that way.
They have a big sign out. Come buy all our stuff.
That's right. In hard times in retail sector, bankruptcy often ends up in what we call liquidation. You just sell off the assets and somebody else continues. Say Best Buy will continue without Circuit City as a competitor. But for industries such as the auto industry, and for many, many companies, and particularly medium-sized to large companies, what bankruptcy means, what filing for bankruptcy means, is not that that you cease to exist, rather that you reorganize, that you restructure, you work something out with your lenders, with your managers, with your employees to get the company back on its feet, get some of this the debt that's sort of put you into financial trouble in the first place, renegotiate that so that you can continue, you can survive. In fact, our primary bankruptcy code in the U.S., which is called the Chapter 11 code, is deemed a reorganization code. That means you go in when you file for Chapter 11 with the idea that you'll come back out again, a reorganized and hopefully healthier company. And if I can just continue a little bit with Chapter 11, the courts and the legislators who wrote the code set it up so that reorganization can be pretty straightforward. During this reorganization process, one of the important things is to keep the company going. You know, not to shut the company down while you renegotiate, but actually to keep the suppliers supplying to the company, keep the employees employed, keep the lights turned on, make sure the utilities don't turn off the lights, let management continue to run the company oftentimes while you're renegotiating this business. So it's actually the characterization I think that the automakers are making before Congress now is actually incorrect, that if GM or Ford has to file for bankruptcy, that they're actually going to be shut down and all these workers are going to be let go, and then everybody that supplies to these car companies are also going to be shut down. That's simply not going to happen. What will happen is if they were to file for bankruptcy, there would be a number of steps that occur almost automatically the day that you file that will keep the company going, moving forward with a good and hopefully viable plan to survive.
11:14 here in the Wake Up Call as we talk with Professor David C. Smith from the McIntyre School of Commerce Undergraduate Business School here at the University of Virginia. Feel free to dial up 979-0919, the toll-free number for those of you further out, maybe the Lovingston 94.7 crowd or the Harrisonburg 95.1 listeners, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. 979-0919, and then there's the instant message, folks, WNRN Studio. We're at AOL. All right, Professor, we talk about the bankruptcy issue for the potential bankruptcy of GM, Ford, Chrysler, et cetera. There was an article that I read, and the quote that came out of it was, "The board has a responsibility to keep all options open considering the circumstances." Yet somewhere else in that article it said, there's no way we're going to file for Chapter 11.
That's right. So the GM's CEO, Rick Wagoner, he's been saying this actually for the last few years. I think GM's been skirting the lines of where many folks have wondered whether or not they're going to file for bankruptcy protection. The CEO, Wagoner, has said, no, we'll never. Bankruptcy is not an option. He said this repeatedly. He said this before Congress. What we're hearing, though, is the board of directors are the group that actually decides who to hire in management, who to fire in management, and who has a fiduciary responsibility to do what's best for the company, not what's best for the manager, but what's best for the company. And we hear them now saying that all options are on the table. And that same article, if it's the same article I read, hence that they've already hired financial advisors, to explore what's the best option for GM.
Is the CEO on the board?
The CEO is on the board.
So is he not representing the board's thoughts, or is just doing it incorrectly? Because the CEO says, not an option.
Right.
And then other people say, yeah, look, it is an option, and it has to be an option. So how do you have board members making different statements to the same media?
So the CEO is often on the board, but I think the way to think about it is he serves at the pleasure of the board, and if the board views the CEO as not making decisions that are in the best interest of the company, it's their duty, their legal duty, to fire him or find some other mechanism to get him going the right way. And oftentimes in these cases, it's not...
I have visions of his arm behind his back as it's being, like, twisted.
It's not unusual for a board to decide to replace the management shortly before they're fired. Now, shortly before they file for Chapter 11. I'm not trying to suggest, I cannot read tea leaves what the board's decision's going to be. The board came strongly out in support of Wagner just a week ago when Congress was hinting both sides of the aisle that perhaps these managers should go as part of a government-led financing package. The board said, we have full confidence in Wagner. They've had plenty of opportunities and plenty of pressure to dismiss him before, and they haven't. So I don't know what's going to happen. But right now, there does seem to be some sunlight in between Wagner and the rest of the board.
All right, we are talking to a university professor, David C. Smith, from the McIntyre School's specialist in bankruptcy and some other parts of the economic world. As we do talk about economy, we are starting with the big three automakers, Ford, Chrysler, and GM, and their recent appeal to the federal government for these bridge loans.
Rick, can I make another point
about always.
The arteries that are supposed to lead to the big three automakers? We heard in the last weeks the automakers say, look, it's not only going to affect our employees, it's going to affect the employees of the auto parts suppliers that supply the parts, the engines, the tires, the paint, and so forth, that they're going to be affected too. And to an extent, that's certainly true. But what's gone on in the background, what these automakers have not sort of revealed or disclosed, that these auto parts makers have really been hurting for a long time because they've been squeezed by the big three automakers. In some ways, they've reneged on pricing contracts. They've used their market power to sort of to really smash these auto parts makers down, while at the same time these auto parts makers have been faced with rising commodity prices. And I've studied a couple of these auto parts makers. Dozens have already had to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Some have come out cleaner, more efficient than they went in. Some haven't come out at all. There's been about 174,000 jobs lost in that sector alone over the last 5 years or so. But they're working hard, very hard, to be as efficient as possible so that they can survive. And these are usually smaller companies, many of them very innovative, very high tech, but because the nature of their business is to provide to two or three customers in the United States, along with some customers abroad, they've taken it on the chin already. And again, no support for them, no voices heard from them until the big three are coming before Congress. Yeah.
All right, 11:20 on the wake up call. With Professor David C. Smith, dial us up or ask your question or comment. Sean is here with the phones today, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, WNRN Studio, if you want to ask your question online. Let me take a moment and tell you the weather markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs in the mid-40s, partly cloudy tonight. Lows in 25 to 30. Cloudy with a little rain tomorrow. Highs in the mid-40s. Warmer in Richmond. Right now, it's a nice day, but chilly across the listening area. 39 in the Valley, 35 in Lynchburg, 39 in Richmond, and a cloud or two in Charlottesville at 36.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, and let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. November is North Face Month at Blue Ridge. Everything from the North Face, including outerwear, books, book packs, footwear, and rain shells on special. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barrack Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville. They're at Wintergreen and in Richmond. Also online at brms.com. And let's give a shout out to JABA. JABA is looking for volunteers to advise seniors about Medicare, Medicaid, prescription drug plans, and other insurance issues. Hours and dates are flexible, and training as a certified insurance counselor is available. For more information, call the WNRN studio line. That's 979-0919, but save that call until after we're done. All right, I see the phone is ringing now. Professor, says David C. Smith from the UVA McIntyre School. Question for you. As we were talking about the possibility, the affected arteries of these big three automakers shutting down potentially, or not shutting down, but filing for bankruptcy protection, wouldn't any layoffs or things like that, if they did lose a lot of their sales, couldn't those jobs and others be moved to Japanese automakers who already have homes here in the United States? I mean, is that where the numbers are going?
Potentially. And I don't want to seem when I'm advocating a filing for bankruptcy protection, I don't want to seem as if I'm as if there's no potential job losses or no potential pain. I don't want to make it seem like I'm not sensitive to the large potential job losses that can occur. But look, these are going to occur whether the companies file for Chapter 11 protection or not. The first argument for one of the great arguments for filing for Chapter 11 protection is that you can get a restructuring, you can get a growing, viable company working again, creating jobs in that particular area. Now, how do you create jobs in an area that's been, say, Michigan, around these auto plants that have really been struggling for now 30 years?
The Michael Moore movie goes back to the early
80s.
Yeah,
right. Michael Moore's, that was one of his, the movie that made him famous, right?
Yeah, Roger and Me.
This is, my memory of the U.S. auto sector having problems goes back to fifth grade, and I'm in my early 40s. So there's several ways this can occur. One is there are, foreign automakers who employ Americans in plants in the United States. They've been very successful in the Southeast, and I think if there was a further shrinking in the upper Midwest where these U.S. plants are located, that this could be a place that these foreign automakers might find valuable to buy the plants, to employ these highly trained workers. Absolutely.
All right, I'm loaded with questions all of a sudden, and we're going to take them in the order that they arrived. All right, we got John from Charlottesville. Hey, John.
Hi, John.
Hello?
Yes, you're on. Fire away with your question.
My question is, if they're planning to bail out the big three, which they consider the American automakers, I'm assuming they're not planning to bail out Toyota or Honda or Hyundai. What is the incentive or the disincentive for foreign governments to start, in essence, subsidizing Hyundai or Honda or Toyota?
Did you get all that?
Yes, I did.
All right, fire away, David. John, I'm going to hang up and let you listen on the radio.
Thank you.
Thanks, John, for the question. No, I think it's a great point. In fact, I believe there's been a little more pushback on both sides of the aisle from Congress, from these executives coming to Washington and asking for this bailout. Of course, it didn't help that they flew in these private jets. But I think some of the resistance is coming from congressmen, both sides of the aisle, in states in which Toyota and Honda and others, BMW, Volkswagen, have set up or plan to set up manufacturing plants because they make that point exactly. We have constituents that are working at these factories. We're not going to help these companies out, or we have no plans to. So why should we help the guys up north who are losing for a variety of competitive reasons.
The next question comes online. What are the critical issues addressed to repair the state of the economy?
That's a big one.
Let's start with the automakers and spread out just a little bit, because we will for the second half hour of the program, we're going to get into a little wider set of questions here about Citigroup banks and the $700 bailout. But you know, touch on that a little bit, and we'll ask this question again when we get to the other part. But how does that apply to the automaker question? What are the main issues that need to be addressed? Because, you know, and I try and poke my thoughts out there, my feelings towards the first 5 minutes of the program if I do a monologue. But let me toss this out there. This is all a bunch of crap, because these businesses have had 30 or 40 years to do it the right way. They've known since the 70s that they should have done cars with greater fuel mileage, and if they weren't going to be the major sellers, that there were people to purchase them, that they were going to be needed, and they have done nothing or near nothing to be prepared for this turnaround in the business. And now they come with their hands out saying, oh, sorry, we didn't know this was going to happen, and you need to help us.
You're right, Rick. I think, look, the best way we can move forward is to facilitate and to encourage the innovation, the creativity that's such a big part of sort of the American dream, the American fabric. We're a nation that's done very well sort of rising up, being proud of our own work ethic, our own creativity, and a desire to compete with the rest of the world on many dimensions and to do well at that. And I think, likewise, economic growth, economic prosperity comes from this innovation and setting up the ability for there to be innovation and for a dynamic economy to evolve and to move forward. What that also means, though, is there's going to be times when, as we technologically move forward and come up with new ways to work and new ways to think, that some industries are going to become less important, other industries are going to become more important. And one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to get caught just trying to push along an industry that is either sort of something that's not going to be a big part of the future. I mean, just think about, say, the stagecoach or horses as a mode of transportation. You know, if we were still working on keeping the stagecoach manufacturing industry going today, what would that mean? Likewise with automobiles. Not to say that automobiles are becoming a thing in the past, but if Japan, say, is better at producing automobiles than we are, and we can't be competitive with that, then we should focus on other areas where we're incredibly competitive: software production, computers. And one way to move forward is just how do we do this? How do we, as individuals, citizens, and how the government does this, is to sort of to get out of the way of dynamic growth. And that includes not spending too much time propping up companies that, you know, come to Washington and give a big sob story for their protection when they're kind of losing at a game that the U.S. is good in many other dimensions, and that is making great products.
I think it was John Stewart who I heard say, if they need money, call Exxon. All right, we do have another call, by the way, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Doug, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, man. Sorry you were third. Fire away with your question or comment.
How did we get where we are now? And I'll just hang up.
All right. So how did the – let's place that again in the realm of the automakers that we've been talking about for the first half hour. How did the government, in terms of being asked for the money, and how did the automakers, in terms of needing the money, get to the positions that they're in?
Well,
Okay, so I think there's two ingredients to where the automakers, you know, how the automakers end up where they are today. Both of these features are just a product of how these automakers have worked and evolved through, say, the last 50 years. The first issue, if we think about, you know, their commitments to their employees, their commitments to their managers, as well as sort of how they've chosen to raise money over the last years, has led to today them having what we call a lot of legacy costs, a lot of overhead. They've made commitments to pay their employees nice high wages, to give them great benefits, to guarantee their employment even through rough times. And not only by that, I don't just mean their current employees, but their past employees. So I just read something in the newspaper this week that for every employee in a U.S. auto plant, there's three employees who've retired, who have fantastic pensions, fantastic health care plans. Now, by itself, that's wonderful, but the problem is that somebody has to pay for those plans. And if you look at the U.S. automakers, their commitments to make these payments through time, sort of on into the future, are very, very high for any company, even a good company, to promise to cover those commitments. The other ingredient is just the U.S. automakers have been losing market share. We could argue about the quality of their products, the quality of their service, the reliability of their products, and certainly these companies very recently have made great strides to change this. But the average consumer, the average U.S. consumer, has been switching away from U.S. autos into foreign-made autos because they're better quality, viewed as being more reliable, viewed as being sort of their dealers as being better at servicing the cars and treating their customers well. And what that means is these automakers have these large legacy costs. At the same time, they're not making very much money. And that's where we got with the automakers. That's where we got to today. That's how we got there today. And it's simple.
All right, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, or WNRN Studio. If you're home listening to us on the radio or on your computer, ring us up, send a message, make a comment. David C. Smith, the professor from the McIntyre School of Commerce. And a sentence or two earlier, you said innovation, and it reminded me the fact that you're also the director the McIntyre Center for Financial Innovation, and maybe I don't know if this is a financial innovation issue, but it's certainly an innovation in terms of manufacturing that these businesses should be more heavily involved in. You were talking about costs, legacy costs, et cetera, with smaller market share. I think one of the issues, and I can't remember where I read this in the past week, but I think this was a comment made by someone from the Senate to one of the automaker CEOs about higher labor costs being compared, that was compared to Japanese automakers. And is that statement meant that they need to cut hourly pay to employees, lay off more people, a little more toning in terms of what they pay themselves? Because everyone gave them incredible grief about flying there on three separate private jets.
Right. I think to the best of my understanding, the hourly wages, let's say, paid at the U.S. auto plants run by foreign car companies like Toyota are very similar to the wages paid at the manufacturing plants in and around Detroit. The big differences currently are along two dimensions. One, in the benefits that are offered, healthcare benefits, pension promises that are made. And that's the one dimension. The other dimension is, I think the automakers down south, Toyota, Honda, use more temporary workers so that they can let go of the temporary workers in hard times and rehire them back in good times, where it's much harder to do that in Detroit. Now, there's been lots of concessions made by the auto unions to make them more competitive with these other U.S. manufacturing plants. And so there's this thinking that by 2010, roughly the two will be equal. Which I think is good for any U.S. automaker that survives or that continues beyond that, beyond, say, a bankruptcy filing or whatever happens the next 6 months. But but that 2010 is still 3 years away, and or two years away, and you know, these guys have been promising a lot of changes, like we said, for 40 years.
And it's also would take place in an area that's already been devastated by job loss and pay cuts, et cetera. And not that you or I really can do much about that, but it seems to me that if they had been more flexible and businesses with more forethought, more foresight, that they would have, they wouldn't have put themselves in this position as well. 11:37 on the wake up call. Who came in first? All right, I got Mark from Harrisonburg. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Question or comment for Professor Smith?
Yeah, I have a question. If $1 trillion is released into the American economy, won't that have, like, secondary effects of, like, huge amount of inflation and $1 trillion? It's so much money.
Can you repeat the first part of your question?
Yeah, one more time, Mark.
If we release $1 trillion into the American economy, like, won't there be secondary effects of that?
All right. Professor?
By releasing trillions of dollars? I'm not quite sure.
I think that's in relation to the $700 billion bailout mm-hmm. as a whole mm-hmm. and all the things that have gone with that. If I'm not mistaken, that AIG's second low-interest loan is on top of the $700 billion, not part of the initial. Back in September, the big three automakers got $25 billion that wasn't included in the $700 billion. Now we're talking about more money again. Is that what you're talking about, Mark?
Yeah.
Is that how you're building to $1 trillion?
Okay.
All right. I'm going to hang up and let you listen. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, Mark. So you're right. We've already made commitments. We the government's already made commitments in the financial sector alone that are approaching $1 trillion. I know that President-elect Obama is planning some stimulus program that will be running the hundreds of billions of dollars. So actually, I think your question is a good one. Spending this money and then finding a way to then for the government to pay for it, either by raising taxes, by borrowing more money, or by just asking the Federal Reserve to print more money, or the Treasury to print more money and the Federal Reserve to release it. Those sort of movements will certainly can certainly put inflationary pressure on the economy. I think in the short run, though, the idea is that even if it sounds expensive, the economy most certainly is in a recession, perhaps possibly a deep recession. I think most people want to think now about, let's see if we can get out of these economic doldrums and worry about the after effects later, but there are very big risks. There are very big risks involved with the economic situation we're in right now. There are very big risks involved with how we, you know, what we do and what are the after effects of getting out of it.
All right, 11:39 on the wake up call. I got another caller or two online. Hang on for just a moment while I do this.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, if you think your portfolio has taken a beating in recent months, it could be worse. UVA's risky ventures used to work well, but have recently cost its endowment nearly $1 billion. Now this week, they explain how it all happened. In 2004, a UVA student filed a federal complaint that the university's policy for handling cases of sexual assault just weren't unfair, they were illegal. 5 years later, she gets the reply she was hoping for. And The Hook's consumer advocate examines a buyer's trouble getting a car loan because of the car dealer's work. The Hook. Every Thursday, we get excited. And let's thank Alt Energy for their support. Alt Energy of Charlottesville, designing and installing solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems are now practical and reliable and can pay for themselves in a few years while reducing your carbon footprint. You can also make a difference by replacing incandescent bulbs with compact fluorescents and showering instead of taking a bath. More is at altenergyincorporated.com. All right, let's get back with Professor David C. Smith, professor at the University of Virginia's McIntyre School of Commerce. And let's see if my man Rick from Harrisonburg is still there. Are you there, Rick?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Thanks for waiting. Question or comment?
No problem. I disagree with the statement your guest made that we should take this Adam Smith type of view that if we're not competitive, or we for a short period of time have become uncompetitive in making automobiles, that we should simply exit that market and focus on something like computer software, which, as we know, is already being farmed to India as fast as possible. The American automakers were forced into a bind, and the bind was that they couldn't compete because of their labor contracts and make money on with small cars. So they had to make big cars, which was okay because their forecast for oil prices were that oil prices for the foreseeable future would stay under $2 a gallon in gas and probably under $55 a barrel. That view was blown up. But if we look at it now, oil prices have come back down. But this spike has really been hard for them to withstand. I've had Buicks for years. I get over 200,000 miles out of the cars, and I'm extremely satisfied. People should know that the Toyota Camry, which has a four-cylinder engine, that broke the back of GM with, was a GM engine. GM designed it. Toyota refined it. And when they've made the best transmissions forever. So I believe in GM as a company. I just think they've been caught in a whirlwind here, and we shouldn't just walk away from the millions of people that are supported by that economy and the many vendors that sell the GM and the technology that they develop are very important. We can't throw it out. Japan doesn't throw out their shipbuilding industry like the United States did. They got better at it, and they said, we've got to make ships. We've got to do these things.
All right, Rick, you're breaking up. You're breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to let the professor respond. Great. I'm glad to get a couple Harrisonburg calls in here. All right, Professor, fire away.
And thanks for the comment, Rick. In terms of this sort of Adam Smith approach to the economy, let me just not give you the impression that I'm, even though I sort of motivated as this thinking about a robust economy as some industries die and some go on, I'm not saying that this should be the end of the U.S. auto industry. On the contrary, I think if you make real steps for restructuring in the auto industry, that may mean having General Motors file for bankruptcy, be cleaned up, get new management in there, figure out better ways to make money, that we could have a competitive U.S. auto industry. If Japan can do it, we can do it. But what I probably would disagree with you on is that it's just this recent the recent spike in oil prices and then a decline afterwards is the reason that our car companies aren't competitive. I mean, Rick and I have already talked about this. It's been 40 years of trouble at these companies. Where you look at other great U.S. manufacturing sectors that we never seem to talk about that have had to struggle with these same sort of restructuring issues and have done very well. The automakers almost stand out as being the ones that can't quite get it right yet.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a license at the time, but I watched enough TV that I can remember the car commercials when 35 miles a gallon was the thing. My goodness, you know, that was what the car manufacturers were pushing was, hey, check it out. This car gets in the 30s for miles per gallon. And this is 30 years ago.
That's right.
And our technology has not improved enough that we can't get 40 or 50 or 60 or 70. I mean, you know, I realize that there is a car or two out there that can do that. But the fact that there aren't more cars or that we can't just say, okay, we've been selling you these big cars because that's what you wanted. But now that you want the other ones, well, we're ready to do that. Within a year's time, we can retool everything and give you more of those rather than having to come ask for all this money. That's just, it's intolerable to me. And again, I realize that I'm tossing some of my own viewpoints out there. And Kirk, hang on 30 seconds. I'm gonna make this comment. There was an interesting point that I saw made by Senator-elect Mark Warner from Virginia that said, because a lot of the conversation has been, what, tell me, you know, automaker companies, what are you going to do before we give you the money? Tell me what you're going to do with it. And one of his comments was, hey, you make some 60, 70, 80 mile per hour cars, and the government will sign a contract that says we'll buy them and put those into use for you. And I thought that that was one of the interesting things. All right. Kirk, are you still there?
Yes.
Thanks for hanging on.
I don't know. I have bought American cars on my perhaps I take some exception to the professor's comments about European cars, foreign cars, being superior to American cars. My record has been extremely good. Good maintenance issues and driving abilities with American cars. But what I see during the 70s, European foreign cars were being bought as a novelty. Honda was real new back then, and I remember people buying those during the 70s. 80s, there seemed to be some misinformation coming out from the car rating magazines, things like rating cars based on engine noise, for one thing, and level of engine noise. Personally, I like engine noise myself. By the 90s, it seemed like we had become well established in buying foreign cars, and then it became what seemed more like a status symbol for certain types of cars.
Kirk, let me jump in here for a second.
Porsches and so on.
Hey, Kirk.
Yes.
Let me jump in for a second. I think that the previous caller, and I'm going to speak for the professor, and he can correct me when I put my shoe in my mouth. I don't believe, from what I've heard, that the professor has said that the foreign cars are better cars. I believe that what he has said was that the foreign car businesses are run and have run themselves in a better manner so that they have not been caught off guard by what is happening economically today.
I agree.
Let me jump in here, too. I mean, I actually I share Rick's view on this, that the big problem is that the car companies themselves haven't run themselves as businesses that need to compete and to produce cars that people want to buy. And partly that is an issue of quality. Not always. There's issues with reliability. There's issues with servicing at the dealer level. And I think there's a variety of facts point to the fact that, and not all foreign car makers do well, you know, but that say Toyota and Honda in particular have done very well at meeting customers' needs on a variety of dimensions. And one just has to look at GM's market share. I think GM's market share in the 80s was, you know, they're 42% of the market in the U.S. were GM cars. People were 42% of the car buyers were buying GM cars. Today, that's 22%. If you look at Ford and if you look at Chrysler, their numbers have similar decline. Meanwhile, Toyota and Honda in the U.S. have become, you know, sort of a dominant preferred car to buy. And there's probably several dimensions for why that's true. We can't deny that fact.
All right. Kirk, thanks for calling. I realize that, you know, we can keep going on and on about that, but and thank you. I realize you're a long-term listener, and thank you very much. 979-0919-1150 here on the Wake Up Call as our hour is winding down and winding down very rapidly. 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor David C. Smith from the University of Virginia's McIntyre School of Commerce. Professor, I'm going to have to ask you to come back and come back shortly, not this once-a-year thing like I do with others, because I got a whole list of stuff we haven't gotten into yet.
I'll be happy to, Rick.
And since the phone line isn't ringing right now in terms of what I assume will probably be an automaker question, explain to me, because also in the news this week has been this possibility of the second largest bank in the United States about Citigroup having these problems, and I would like to know how that ties into this whole need of give me money so that we can make it through, or by Citigroup being purchased by someone. Are they going to be purchased by the largest bank in the United States? And if not, how does anyone else, you know, go in and say, oh, you're bigger than me, but I'll buy you?
Yeah, right. So in some sense, that's the elephant that's been standing in the living room all hour, in that we haven't talked about the disaster that's we've seen unfold in the financial sector. And certainly in today's show, we don't have enough time to cover that. Let me just say that we can sort of separate the discussion about the automakers from the gigantic problems we've also had in our financial sector, in that the automakers problem has been something that's been around for a long time. If anything, recent financial interruptions, which themselves have been painful and significant, that's sort of the straw that's broken the back, I would argue, for U.S. automakers. So turning to the financial sector, look, there's we've been having some awful problems and some embarrassingly awful problems in the financial sector, and we're not out of the woods by any stretch yet. And the latest evidence of these problems has been in the indication that Citigroup, one of the nation's largest banks, financial institutions, is in trouble, may itself be on the verge of bankruptcy. And one thing that Rick was getting at that I want to try to address very quickly is, you know, we've seen lots of government money flowing to these large financial institutions, including Citi. Citigroup's already had a $25 billion commitment, roughly the same commitment that was that legislators were looking for the auto industry. And yet they're still struggling. And even though I'm a finance professor, I don't really have a simple answer as to what to do. What I would like to say is that Citi should go the same way that any other company that we've been arguing for should go. They should go through a bankruptcy process or something like that, be restructured, and if they're not fit to survive and to continue, then they should be sold off or liquidated or something that allows the healthier financial companies to continue. That said, there's several issues. Banks are different in the sense that they hold folks' money, and people don't want to hear that they're the place that they've been storing their money, like thinking about a big safe or where their deposits are, going out of business. There's also reverberations in our system when a large financial institution that's involved with so many financial transactions, not only in the United States but around the world, when its business gets interrupted, the entire financial system feels its ripples, and that transfers down to us as individuals. So there's a historical belief in the United States, dating back at least to the beginning of the 20th century, that we have to be more careful to treat banks differently. I don't think that means that we should be bailing out banks or bailing out the managers of these banks, so that they get a second chance in a way that the U.S. automakers don't get a second chance. But the way that we treat them or the way that we handle it may be a little bit different. And for Citigroup, you know, may mean that you find healthy financial institutions, a group of them, and you sell them off in pieces. But right now, it's too early to tell.
All right, you are listening to WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar, Amherst Lynchburg, 11:54 here in the Wake Up Call. Just the final few minutes with Professor David C. Smith. Don't be going anywhere, as you might possibly be thinking. Drew Thompson's here for Les Temps Purdue. It's 80s and 90s alternative. Tune in for it next. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. And let me take a moment and thank 45fix.com. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4 and the number 5 and the word fix.com. Professor, I realize that we're down to the last few minutes of the program, and any questions that I ask here are not going to get the full detail that they deserve. But we touched on the $700 billion bailout in the previous question. But a couple pieces that I don't understand about that are, it's 2 months later and half possibly of the money has not been used. And my understanding from that is, aside from helping a few of the banks and financial institutions, that a chunk, a fair sized chunk of that money was to go to help prevent foreclosures, to halt the foreclosures. And neither of those, that hasn't happened, and there's all this money still out there to be used. Why are we in this predicament?
I think there's a struggle still going on as to what is the best way to help out.
Great Britain did this in like 2 weeks, correct? And I'm not saying that we need I'm not sure that we need to follow another country's format, but you have another large country who had similar issues, and whether or not they took the right path, they took one and are going to live with what happens rather than standing by while other stuff happens. You know, the United States seems to be waiting for the path to be selected for them.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of rooting around, a lot of switching gears, two steps forward, one step back, and trying to figure out how best to use this money. There's clearly a recognition, I think, across the board that there needs to be something done to help slow down or to mitigate the impact of so many potential foreclosures. And banks have already started doing this, as well as efforts by the FDIC to renegotiate some loans to knock off some of the principal or stretch the principal payments out so that folks that right now can't afford to stay in their houses would be able to afford that house and the state in it. We're at a very early stage. I think one way to look at this, though, Rick, just to give the folks who are trying to work this out some credit, you know, this has really come crashing down on us around September 15th, so we're about 6 weeks into it. This is going to be a problem that's going to be around longer than 6 weeks. I agree that the faster that we move, we can't be sitting around twiddling our fingers as these things unfold. But letting these different groups work at this to think about how get the best way to spend this money rather than just spending it haphazardly is probably a good idea. And I mean, at the end of the day, it'd be great to have for anybody who bought a house. Can't afford it. The bank's option is to foreclose and sell it for less than the bank was hoping to get on it, less than the loan's amount, just to let those homeowners stay in there and make lower payments. Problem with that is then you do create incentives for folks who could afford it just to say, well, why can't I have lower payments too? You give me lower payments too, and sort of you have this house starting to tumble down. And I think that's what they're worried about, but they're going to keep working on this.
All right, one last question, quick time, quick response. It's 11:59 before Drew starts up. I heard the word negative inflation used, or the phrase negative inflation, because gas prices were going down and how that was a bad thing. How? Please, quickly.
So negative inflation, or what's also commonly called deflation, is just the opposite of inflation. It's a general decline in prices brought about by prices falling across.
And why is that bad?
Well, that's a good question, because inflation's always, we always think of inflation bad, and those of us who grew up and lived in the 70s remember how bad it was. Deflation can be bad. Japan experienced deflation because then folks, in anticipating that things are going to be cheaper in the future, they keep delaying consumption. They keep saying, hey, yeah, things are cheaper than they were last week, but hey, if I can wait another month, they'll be even cheaper, and nobody spends money, and that's bad for the economy.
All right. Professor David C. Smith, from the McIntyre School of Commerce and director of the McIntyre Center for Financial Innovation. Can I get you to come back on in January sometime?
Sure.
All right.
Thanks very much, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
That was a wonderful show. I want to thank all the callers who dialed us up and the instant message questions as well. Drew Thompson up next with Les Temps Purdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.